Welcome to A Legion of Three. I'm Robert.
I'm Glenn.
I'm John.
And tonight we're talking about Savage Weapons. This is an old story. I mean, this is from Horus Heresy Book 10. It's actually, I think, the first time we see a short story from Aaron Dembski Bowden. Anybody correct me on that?
Sounds right.
Good, good. I make shit up and people don't call me on it. But it's a really fine story. It actually features the Dark Angels, who are not my favorite legion, and the Night Lords, who are also not my favorite legion, but are in the running to be like second place, because they're so damn good at being evil. They're not evil like the Word Bearers. They're their own special kind of bastard.
I'll second that.
Do I get a third?
Why are they so good yet so bad?
Well, I mean, so the thing about it is that they don't fall to chaos. They have this, I'd say it's a code of honor, but that may be too strong a word. They have this idea of justice and retribution. Now, the problem is that their idea of justice and retribution are way beyond the pale. And, you know, any infraction on Nostromo was punishable by death. Mm-hmm. That's a lot. I mean, that's kind of a tough legal code. Like, oh, you clipped a nail and you didn't sweep it up, off with your head.
Which is why pretty much every single person or Marine in their chapter is censured for death.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's something that comes up in this, is, and I'm pretty sure it's the first time it's ever mentioned, and you don't get any explanation why, but it's either for fools or failures. And what is, oh man, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name.
There's editing here. Sevatar?
Thank you. Which one is Sevatar?
Sevatar is the psyker with the halberd.
No. Is he a fool or a failure?
I'm sure he's a failure.
He's a little bit of both, I think, how he answers it.
He's a failure because he's a psyker.
But he represses it, and you're way ahead. So, yes. So, Sevatar does, in later stories, reveal that he is a psyker. He has suppressed it his whole life until it comes out in Prince of Crows, where he uses it a little too much. Trying to save his Primarch's life for reasons that he can't himself articulate other than it's his father. Anyway, so we're jumping around, but let's get into the story. Who would like to start us off?
You would.
Fine, I'll start us off. So the first chapter is from the point of view of the Dark Angel, who is our main character of the Dark Angel, Corswain. It basically is his childhood on... Why is every name skipping out of me?
Caliban.
Caliban. God. Like, you don't record in a month, and suddenly all the names slip out of your head. He is a company commander of the Dark Angels, and he is serving along with his Primarch as Equerry, or does that come later?
I think it came later.
Okay. So he's serving along, and this takes place during the Thramas Crusade. And the Thramas Crusade was basically Horus assigned to the Night Lords to trip up the Dark Angels, to basically keep them out of the other fighting. And they did this by basically making a reign of terror throughout an entire region. It's more than one sector, I think, of space. And we see that the battles go poorly. You know, they win here, they lose there. Anytime they make a move, the Night Lords make a counter move. It's really just going poorly. And when the Night Lords take a planet, they don't just, you know, take the planet. They strip everybody of their skin, make an example of them, and then leave this desiccated husk behind. So it's kind of bad when the Night Lords take over because they don't just, you know, it's very scorched earth and then some. So all of this is taking place, and it's basically wearing very heavily on the First Legion. Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Shall I continue?
Continue.
Okay. So hang on. I'll jump in with something. I'm going to talk just for a second about Corswain. I can't remember which book it was. There's the first couple of books about the Dark Angels.
The Sent of Angels or the other one, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So Corswain, he was born on Caliban, but he wasn't like part of the original group of knights that Lionel Johnson was part of. And he kind of came in between after the Terrans found, or the Emperor found and was reunited with Lionel Johnson and still had the original First Legion guys from Terra. And then before, like, the first ranks of the Caliban-born legionnaires were raised. So he's kind of in the middle.
The middle child?
Yeah, I remember that from reading those books, is that he was kind of different in that he was from Caliban, but he also kind of got to see kind of the aspects of the Terran-born Dark Angels and interact with them. And he was kind of a unique to himself, and he was part of, you know, he became part of the honor guard for Lionel Johnson. So
yeah, and I just looked it up. Corswain was not a psyker. He was possibly one of the best swordsmen in the First Legion. So yeah, I stand corrected.
And through all of the legions, he's one of the guys who they look upon as a master swordsman. But on the same side of the coin, so is Sevatar. You know, like Raldoran or whatever. They're all like the pinnacle of their legion, but against each other, not sure who's going to win that fight. And probably the guy whose latent psychic powers get channeled into being a better fighter kind of has the lead. So, okay.
Yeah. All
right. So we meet Corswain. He's at prayer, basically, and he is summoned to go see Lionel Johnson. So they go visit Lionel Johnson. He is sitting on his throne on the ship that they are upon, which the name doesn't say on my thing. But basically, you know, they're reviewing the latest news from the Thrawn's Crusade, and it goes poorly. I mean, there's the people under his command, obviously, besides the Dark Angels, are just not as disciplined, which, of course, in the eyes of Lionel Johnson, nobody's as disciplined as the Dark Angels. They are the pinnacle of all the legions, right?
In their eyes, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So basically he says, 2 years of void skirmishes, 2 years of planetary sieges, 2 years of global invasions or worldwide retreats, orbital assault and shipboard evacuation, and we have a chance to end it at last. So basically, there's a offer to parlay coming from the Night Haunter, from Conrad Kurz, that Lionel Johnson should meet him on this abandoned world, and they should have a little chat.
It's a trap.
It's a trap. You know, they know it's a trap. They definitely look upon this with, you know, you got to be kidding, right? But it's an opportunity for them to possibly end the war, and the war is not going well. I mean, they're not losing, but they're not winning either. It's very much a stalemate. It's very much whenever one gets the upper hand, the other one takes it right back situation. So the Lion says, you know, he's been chasing his brother and his accursed legion for 26 months, you know, just burning everything before they can catch him. They cripple supply routes. They just tear everything down. They flay people and leave, you know, ghost worlds behind. So this opportunity, even though it's probably a trap, at least is an opportunity that he could possibly kill Conrad Kurz and end the war. And this part of the war, anyway, the Thrawn's Crusade. So he takes a small force because he doesn't want to risk everybody falling in the trap, which, of course, makes it so much better. And they head off for this world. And the name of the world, John?
Sagwalsa, I believe is how they say it. I think so.
Yeah, yep.
Sagwalsa. Sorry. Sagwalsa. Like they took some alphabet soup and threw it down the steps.
Right.
And then walked down and figured out what stuck to their shoe and said, okay, we're going to make that.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So basically he's going to take himself and two men, and he's going to go down to Sagwalsa and onto the surface of Sagwalsa, and they're going to meet with their counterparts, Conrad Kurz and two of his chosen men. They basically keep the strike cruiser that they come in on, Feminence, on full alert, but far enough from the planet to not be ambushed, but close enough to the planet that if it needs to come rescue the Lion and his men, that it's capable of doing so. They note that there is a small fleet, not a big one, but a small fleet on the opposite side of the world, and it's keeping its distance. You know, they're not, if it's a trap, they're not springing the trap yet. They find on the world evidence that there was a fortress being constructed, but for some reason they just stopped. And that's never really explained what happened there. It may be explained in another story that I'm not familiar with, but I think it's just kind of left as a mystery, right?
I thought they did basically say that later on that was where the Night Lords went back. They basically created a new homeworld for themselves there, or a base of operations there.
Right. Yeah, they did use it later. So I think in the Great Crusade, this is a world that is later involved that I think the Lion comes to burn, basically. But I don't know why at this point.
Isn't that where he dies?
He's not dead.
No, Nighthawker.
No.
Is it where the assassin catches him and kills him?
I'm not sure about that. It's a good question. Somebody should look that up. Yeah. I don't know that that's actually established because, yes, his death is established that he saw it coming and he knew it was happening. He welcomed it, basically. But I don't know if it says where.
It does. I just looked it up. Eventually, the Caliph's assassin, M. Shen, located the Night Hunter on Saguasa and managed to infiltrate the palace, stealing into his throne room. So that is where he dies. So they actually come back and reuse this much longer. So
interesting. And I know that there's further battles here after the final Siege of Terra is wrapped up, because I know the Night Lords, for whatever reason, like this place. I don't know that they detail why, other than it's, well, it's weird because the Night Lords, you'd think they'd want a place where they could kill people and not, be quiet. I don't know. All right. Anyhow, so they head down, they come to the world, and it's totally quiet. It's apparently abandoned. There's, again, the evidence of a fortress that was halted. I should say they teleport down, which is kind of interesting because I think this is, it's pretty rare that teleportation is discussed in 30K. It's semi-common in 40K for Terminators. In fact, in 9th edition, deep striking is more common than it was in previous editions, I'd say. Right. But in 30K, it's pretty rare. You don't really hear much about teleportation, and we see that Corswain's not really a big fan. It's kind of horrible.
Well, let's think about this for a half a second. You're standing on top of a bunch of technology that you don't understand. They've just ran the plasma engines for like 7 full minutes just to get up enough energy to start. And the ship's navigators and astropaths are involved in directing your soul through the warp from one place to another.
Sounds like a party to me. What's your problem?
What's there to be afraid of? I mean, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it basically, and the thing he likes about it the least is that it basically disorients you for a little while. It takes some time to get your bearings back from your little trip through the warp. But luckily, upon landing, there are no ambushes. Again, it's all very like, we know this is coming, and it's suspenseful. There's a trap coming. We know it's going to happen. We know we're all, going to get night-lorded up. But when? We don't know when. So they finally, wait and wait and Nighthunter teleports in with his men. And it describes when Corswain sees him for the first time as a cadaverous god in midnight clad, which, as we know, is the Night Lord's mantra. Each armored finger ending in a charged blade the length of a scythe. Black hair at the mercy of the world's winds streamed from a corpse's face. Chained skulls rattled against warplate etched with runic writing rejoicing in past massacres and celebrating atrocity against the Empire of Humanity. This husk of nobility, this emaciated wraith now no more than the shadow of a prince, bared teeth filed to fangs as he opened his arms to the lion, offering a welcome embrace.
It's Severus Snape as a Space Marine.
Don't cross the streams, Glenn.
Nice. That is an awesome way to phrase and frame him. I mean, he is a cadaverous god,
yeah.
Among other ones. There's a couple other ones, but if anybody looks like a corpse, it's him. It's Curves.
Because he doesn't care about his appearance one bit. No. He literally is unwashed, unshaven, un-everything, unkept. The fact that his armor works is kind of amazing. That's just because he's got servants to do that. And even so, his armor probably has not been painted in a cycle. The lion would never allow that to happen to his warplate.
Never.
Ever.
Yep. Yeah. Always got to be flawless.
Which is probably something that grates on the lion, because the lion is, he believes himself to be the best of everything.
Right.
He did feel slighted when Horus became the Warmaster.
Well, lots of them did, but yeah, certainly did. Yeah.
I'm certain that he did.
Yeah.
But at the same, in the same sentence, he has been playing cat and mouse with Conrad Kurz for the better part of 26 months.
The worst of them.
The worst of all of the Primarchs, especially in his own mind, I'm sure.
Well, and all right. You know what? I take it back. It's possible
Lorgar
might rate lower, but only a little bit. It's a close race. It's a race for the bottom, and then they start digging. But yes, yeah, Lorgar, just because, you know, Lionel Johnson doesn't respect psychic power. You know, at least Nighthaunter, for all of his many, many, many faults, fights like a banshee. I mean, he can just kill people like the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah, because he has no regard for himself, because he knows at that point in time he's not going to die. It won't kill him.
Right. He's not afraid of death because it's not his time. Right. And that makes him a very powerful enemy.
I was somewhat reminded of the scene in the original Highlander movie where the Christopher Lambert character...
The Highlander?
The original Highlander, yes. Where he had called the one guy's wife a bloated warthog, and the other guy took offense to that and challenged him to a duel.
Imagine
and killed
that.
Him. Killed him like six times in a row until finally Christopher Lambert's character sobered up enough to apologize and bid him a good day and walk away. It's Conrad Kurz. He knows when he's going to die, so he can get out there and fight. It doesn't matter. He knows when he's going to die, so yeah, whatever. I'm going to take this sword in the gut. Whatever.
It's going to hurt, but that's okay. So yes, Kurz does not look like, you know, the ideal of a Primarch. And they talk about this. Humanity is completely awed by Primarchs, but so are Space Marines. Space Marines, even if it's not your Primarch, it's still a god among superhumans. So they're awed by this walking corpse cadaver thing, but in a bad way. It says, to Corswain's eyes, Kurz was a pathetic, ghoulish in comparison to the lion. A wretched husk facing a night lord. Tonight. K-N-I-G-T-H. Lord. Claws against a prince's sword. So they have a little chat. The two brothers. They basically walk off and, you know, have a discussion that's off camera. We don't get to hear it. Except, you know, they talk at the beginning of it. Of why Conrad Kurz betrayed the Emperor. But not much of it.
I thought that was really good. I will ask you this once. Only.
Yeah.
Why did you betray our father? And Kurz replies, I would ask you something in return, brother, Kurz answered with a grin, his filed teeth on display. The clawed Primarch's eyes were unhealthily bright, rich with a secret sickness. Why did you not? Like, ooh.
And that's kind of, I mean, it's the duty versus the you are a puppet, you know, kind of thing. It's like they're both kind of outraged at their other's behavior. Although I'm pretty sure Kurz, even though the War Masters ultimately did send him here to try to get Lionel Johnson to turn, he knows there's no chance of that. I mean, this of all the Primarchs, there is zero chance of him and Roboot too. I mean, they're both very loyal to the Emperor to a fault. I guess most of the loyalists are, but anyway, these two, above all, are bootlickers to him.
Hang on a second. Do you honestly believe that the War Master sent Kurz to try and turn the lion?
He wanted to give him the offer. Yeah, I think this whole conversation is really Horus bid Nighthaunter to do this, to try and get him to do it. I don't think this was... I mean, it's an ambush, yes, but it's not a very good ambush, because... He could have been dead. They could have just hit him from orbit.
All right.
So that's more of a tactic.
I would save this for later, but I'm going to do it now while it's fresh in my head.
Uh-oh.
I don't think that is the case. I honestly believe that Kurz saw that this might play out the way that it did, where he could leave the invitation, that his brother would find it, and his brother would meet him together on this planet of Sigwalsa, and that the two of them would be together and would fight. And I believe that after fighting the lion to a standstill for 26 months, Kurz wanted to get face to face with the lion and bring the lion down to his level.
Yep.
Because the lion believes himself so much better than the rest of his brothers. And Kurz not only has proven for 26 straight months that he's not, that he can't beat him, but he's going to be face to face. It's not his armies. It's not his legions. It's not his fleet. It's the two of them, man to man. And it's going to come down to a low down, dirty blow that I'm sure the lion hates himself for having done, but he brings himself right down to Kurz's gutter trash knife fight in a phone booth level.
Right, just, but I think Kurz is trying to do that to all the Primarchs.
I'm sure he is, but
Kurz is trying to prove a point. Yes,
of all of them, the lion, because the lion believes himself better than the rest. And Kurz is like, no, you know what, dude? You are just like us. You call us trash, you're trash. Check it out.
Right. We're brothers. How can you be that different from me, brother?
Right.
At this point, Kurz has already nearly killed Dorne.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been so bad.
Yeah. How many times has he killed Vulcan?
Hundreds of times. But you know, spoiler warning. So disappointed that didn't work.
Why won't you die?
Yeah, that is the best part of that book, is he's like, I have killed you this way, and 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 none of it stuck. What the hell? It's like he got bored of killing him. It was not going well.
Don't even have the common decency to die.
All right. Sidetrack. All right. So I agree. No, I'm not saying your point is wrong. I think that that's probably something to do with it. I do think, I mean, he says as much, that Horus sent him there to give him the message. And then at the same time, he's taunting him. He basically says, you know, you're never going to get to Earth. The warp is not going to allow it. I'm not going to allow it. Our father's empire is going to die and burn, and you will have failed him. And that's really when the sword comes out and comes into somebody's throat. Because he basically does. He gets him down to his level by taunting him, and the good, noble, knight lord, K-N-I-G-H-T, damn it, that's hard to spell when you're in a hurry, basically falls at that point. He basically falls for the ruse and dives right in. But we jump ahead, because before we have that lovely stab, we have a lovely conversation between their equerries. They're men that are with him, Corswain and Alahos and Sevatar and Shang.
Yep.
And we learn that Alahos and Sevatar have a little history. Earlier on the story, we learned that Alahos's face is kind of barely stitched back together and stapled and whatever. He had a bad run-in with a Night Lord who basically carved off half of his face. And the Night Lord in question is
Sevatar, of course. Sevatar.
Yes. The greatest swordsman, non-Primarch, of course, in the Night Lords. So there's a little conversation between them. It kind of just, they start off very friendly, which, you know, is a lie. But Sevatar, I think Sevatar actually does enjoy, you know, having friendly banter with the enemy when he knows he can kill them all. You know, that's a very important thing to him, is that he is afraid of absolutely no one. He's not really even afraid of Nighthaunter. He's disappointed by him. But he loves just having this little friendly chat and thinking, I'm going to carve all of you into little chunks of sushi.
It describes there on what the Night Lords are wearing, that they actually are wearing some of the Dark Angel's helmets.
Yeah.
As trophies.
Yeah, on their, you're right. But the, you know, the good news is that to them, at least, is a mark of honor. This was, they died worthy, not, you know, a screaming little, well, yeah. Yeah.
No, it's still, I mean, if you're a Dark Angel, you see one of your, you know, a possible battle brother, or definitely a battle brother's helm hanging from someone else's belt, you're like, really, really, Dick, you're really going to do that? You're going to bring that here?
I knew that guy. He still owes me money.
I'm gonna kill you twice for that.
So there's a lovely little exchange of words, and it turns out that Corswain speaks fluent Astraman, although Sevatar says your accent is brutal. and he says something horrible about their mothers, I think. I don't remember exactly what it was.
I think it's that they slept with pigs.
Yes. Yes. So, and then we learn about the Red Hands, and Sevatar says, "This is a gang tradition from ours," talking about Nostromo. "The hands of traitors and fools were tattooed red by their families to show them as death mark, a sign that no gang or family would tolerate grave failure, and that the condemned still had labors to perform before they were allowed to die. So which are you, a traitor or a fool?" The Night Lord's voice revealed his own smile, even if his soulless helm did not. "Both." Oh, yeah, here it is. What did you say in their snake tongue? "I told them that I knew they mated with pigs." Not their mothers, just them.
Yeah, that's cool.
"Why would they laugh at such an insult? Because they are not knights. They possess honor of a kind that is simply different to ours. I would say that is very true. That is the most true statement in this entire story."
Mm-hmm.
And the Night Lords, I mean, they're not just, you know, crazy killers the way that the World Eaters are. They're not crazy adherents of a faith the way the Word Bearers are. They believe that they're dishing out a justice, although now the justice is, we're just going to take it to the Imperium.
Yeah. Well, right here they are that way, but later on we see in these other stories that it's more like they're more like gangs.
Yeah, and I think part of it too is that's the difference between some of the later generation and Sevatar's generation, because Sevatar himself still does regard the Night Lords as a, I don't know, I wouldn't say necessary evil, but at least he sees their purpose and their purity in doing things to make people terrified of them. I mean, that was the same original idea of the World Eaters, too. It was the threat of the World Eaters was so grave that people would surrender versus them dropping on the planet. And the same for the Night Lords. You know, they if they did horrible things, people would fall into compliance because they did not want that shit here.
Right.
Now, the other legions abhorred that. They hated them for that. But it's true. I mean, they talk about a story. I think it was the Salamanders and the Night Lords working together. And Kurz himself flayed, you know, like a bunch of governor people on a planet and like one continent's rulers. And the Salamanders are like, "What in the hell are you doing?" And like all the other continents suddenly capitulated. They're like, nope, we're done. We surrender. Good God, keep him away from us. And it worked. I mean, it was a horrible atrocity, but it got results. And that's kind of what the Night Lord stood for, at least the ones who didn't camp. The later ones really were just crazy butcherers.
Yeah, all the Primarchs had their method. And a bunch of them weren't liked by other Primarchs.
Yes. Yeah, nobody really. I mean, just, you guys have, well, John doesn't have a brother. Come on, you have brothers. You don't agree with the way your brother does things. Your brothers do things. Yeah, I mean, we can relate to that. Imagine if you had 17 brothers, or really 19 brothers, and two that made an example of.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. All right. So after the friendly exchange of words between the Night Lord Equerries and the Dark Angel Equerries, the Lion and L. Johnson come. I'm sorry. The Lion and Night Hunter come back, still chatting, still kind of trading light barbs. You know, the Lion calls him basically a coward and you know, running away, hiding like vermin before the fleeing of dawn. And Kurz is just like, whatever. You know, we're winning this war and you're not. You are failing. Will the human descendants of this Imperium look to your legend and whisper of doubt? Will they ask you why you were not present to defend the homeworld and speak likely lies that perhaps the Lion was not as loyal and true as the mighty, perfect Rogel Dorne? Perhaps the Lion and his Dark Angels waited in the deepest reaches of space, watching, listening, deciding to join the fight only when the obvious victor emerged. That is your fate, Lion. That is your future. And I think that got to him on a deep level, because suddenly
he stabbed it in the
sword.
Forgive me, brother. Kurz tilted his head. For what? Kurz Wayne was watching both Primarchs, yet still never saw what happened. Such was the speed of the Lion's movements. One moment, the two brothers were speaking, the Lion's features cast down in contemplation. Kurz's eyes fever bright as he promised an ignoble fate. The next, Kurz's features twisted into a taut rictus of pain, blood running between his clenched teeth. The Lion held tight to the grip of his blade, buried to the hilt in his brother's stomach. More than a meter of shining, blood-stained steel thrust from the back of Kurz's armor.
So That's quite a blow. That went through one set of armor, through a gaudy, the body of a god, and out the back of his armor.
It's a sharp sword.
Quote, "For such a dishonorable blow," the lion whispered into Kurz's pale, bleeding face. "I do not care who knows the truth now, tomorrow, or in 10,000 years. Loyalty is its own reward."
And then he pulls the sword out, which I think is probably not the best move.
Oh, he should have wrenched it up.
Right.
Yeah. Or down.
Kick it a little bit. Yeah, that's it.
Make him have longer legs. That would have been great.
Separated from his legs.
Yeah. That's a pretty impressive blow. I mean, in all things, even though it was a surprise, yes, you psychics didn't see that coming, did they? That was, I mean, and anybody else, that had been a kill shot, too. Not many people take swords through the gut, out the back, terribly well.
Right. And it had to go out through the bottom of his backpack, too. I mean, that's one thing that I noticed that they don't describe a lot when it comes to the stories, is they have backpacks. I mean, they have the generators on their back. And, you know, they say, you know, it was ran through his chest, through his back. And it's like, well, did it go through the backpack, too? Did it explode? I mean, it's like sometimes they're missing something here.
Yeah.
Well, you could have. It depends on the angle of the blade. He could have rammed it straight through at the belly button and straight out the other side.
Right.
And that would still be out his back, just below the backpack.
Right.
Not very cinematic, though.
Right.
No, and they do talk in one of the stories, if I can dredge it up from long-term storage, it's either Istvan 3 or Istvan 5, where they talk about Marines getting so damaged that their backpack reactor goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that is a thing.
Yeah. You're right. It doesn't come up very often. Most of the time they tend to ignore their power packs.
Yeah.
Or jump packs too. You know, when they're wearing jump packs.
They're walking around with nuclear reactors. I mean, you would think these things would blow up way more often.
No, you're thinking Ghostbusters.
Unlicensed particle accelerator.
That's right.
These are licensed fully by the Emperor.
Yes. Each one. Fully stamped. All right. Yeah.
This is number one. This is number two. All the way up to a million.
So for the first time, the Night Lords don't get to spring the ambush. The Lion has sprung the ambush. But immediately, the Night Lords fall back away from Corswain and Alahos. They
straight up disappear.
Yes. Poof,
gone.
They basically duck into cover. But you can hear the chain blade on Sevatar's halberd snarl to life. And that thing is mighty murderous in the hands of Sevatar. So Corswain calls back to their strike cruiser, Venomous, and basically warns them that they have engaged the enemy, and so watch out for what happens with the enemy fleet. The captain asks if they'd like a teleportation recall, but that's not going to happen right now. They're hoping that the Lion can defeat Nighthaunter, even though the odds of that are not great. But he basically tells her, you can't maintain a recall lock right now. We don't know where the enemy is. So just, send in the cavalry.
So Corswain and the captain that are with him, they're both of the 9th company. Whereas Sevatar and, what was it, Chen?
Shang.
Shang. And Shang are, like, elite.
Yep.
So they're way outmatched.
Well, Corswain, again, is the best swordsman probably in the First Legion. But yes, Shang is better than Alaho. Alaho is recovering still from having his face sawn off.
Yeah.
And Sevatar is better than all of the above.
Sounds like the Lion brought in his 9th best guys he could have brought in, not his first best, like what Kurz brought.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't have, not everybody is with him at the same time, too. You know, this wasn't the whole fleet together, as I understand it. So he took what he could.
Yeah, they may have been the best of the rest.
Right. And again, Corswain's no slouch. He is a hell of a fighter. All right. So we flip back to the Primarchs, who are fighting, even though Kurz is bleeding. It is slowly, well, quickly, for what it is, a gut wound, sealing shut, and he fights like a madman. He basically has no defense, all offense, just flailing.
I like that line. He fought as he always fought, like a killer backed into a corner. Brutal scythes slashing from their housings on the back of the Primarch's oversized gauntlets, and the air rang with the clash of metal against metal, with the fizzing crack of opposing power fields. The lion's got a single sword. Right? I'm sure he's armed with other weapons, but at this point, they only say that he's got a single sword out. And it's, I'm assuming, double-edged, because everything that the Dark Angels use pretty much is double-edged, versus a pair of lightning claws. Or are they special? Are Kurz's claws? I know they're special.
They're a special claw, yeah. They're huge. Yeah. Yeah, and they're basically, unlike lightning claws, which are kind of, you know, from the hands, his are like fingers. So his are more, have more articulation to them. There's a short story, non-Horse Heresy. It's, I think it's by William Gibson. Oh, maybe not. Anyway, it has a human person in it. Who is a crazy trained killer person. And there's, John, you may have read this, but it may ring a bell in a minute. He constantly has the chattering of a computer in his ear. He basically has this little earbud in his ear that keeps him regulated. And when the earbud is out, you know, he basically can just remember that he's a crazy killer and kill people. But they talk about in this story, he's infiltrating this group and he meets one of his counterparts who he recognizes as the same training that he's had or whatever else. And it talks about them fighting and it talks about there's like zero elegance in their fighting. They're basically highly twitching like feral cats just flying at each other, claws and teeth and everything and jittering. And that makes me think of Kurz. I mean, he has absolutely no grace. He is just attack, 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 a whirlwind of claws and, you know, lightning blue. Versus, you know, on your other side, you have the lion, who it says he sounds almost bored while he is, you know, basically in just defensive mode. He can't.
We never sparred, did we? The lion sounded almost bored, his words still carrying over the box. Every few seconds would see a new cut ripped open in Kurz's armor or slashed across his face. He was fast enough to avoid death at the lion's hands, but not skillful enough to flawlessly defend against every attack. I never cared for swords, Kurz weaved under the carving blade, thrusting out with both claws. The lion tilted back, his balance executed to preternatural perfection. Kurz's claws shredded the ivory tabard, barely scratching the lacquered ceramite beneath.
So, but it's crazy, and again, you know, it says there's a knight versus a murderer. The way that they fight is completely different, at least for now. It doesn't stay this way. Kurz continues to goad him on. He says, "You should be with us, brother. Even your own legion senses it. The First Legion strife is not unknown to the War Master," which is funny because the Lion has not acknowledged that any strife of that sort, and he can't. You know, as we know him, he can't even fathom it. But we know what's going on back at the homeworld.
Yeah, Caliban. Right.
There is no strife. Their blades locked in that moment. Kurz is catching the lion's sword in his net of linked claws. No, the Night Lord spat. The word is a curse. No risk of the fair angels falling. When did you last walk upon the soil of Caliban, oh proud one?
Yeah, it's good stuff. So, basically, they fight, and Kurz slowly takes the lead, basically. I feel like he's winning, which is why Corswain comes to try and even up the score by putting his sword into Conrad's neck, which I know I said earlier that the lion put a sword in his neck. Lion went for the stomach. Corswain goes for the neck. You know, it's all good.
Right.
It's pretty impressive. And then the cost of this, though, is that Alaho comes between Sevatar and Shang to buy Corswain some time with his life.
Well, Kurz catches the lion, knocks him down, and starts slamming his head into the pavement.
Yeah, basically the back of his head is just a pulp.
Yep.
If he didn't do that, if Corswain didn't do that, there's a good chance that he would have killed the lion. So
lose a captain or lose a Primarch.
Well, you can grow Primarchs back, right?
No, you can get a new captain, though.
Nice. So, actually, this... I skipped over this, but this does say, you know, that Corswain is numbers other Legionis Astartes warriors capable of besting him fewer than 20 across all the legions. And I basically count that as one per legion. You know, Abaddon, Jubal Khan, Sigismund, and Sevatar, all better than him, probably.
Lucius.
Yeah, Lucius. Oh. Who's the one from the Raven Guard? We had his name last time.
Nykona Sharokin.
Yep.
Sharokin. So cool.
Good
so
recall.
Cool. Yep. Well done. But yes, basically he goes to save the lion from having the back of his head blown out and loses Alaho as a consequence. Alaho basically tears off his helmet, showing Sevatar his work and says, come finish it, brother. And he does.
Yes, he does.
And it's this cool scene. He says, I am Alaho, captain of the Ninth Order of the First Legion, brother to all knights, son to one world, sworn to one lord. And Sevatar's like, yeah, yeah, I'm Sevatar the Condemned. Chunk.
And I will wear your skin as a, cloak,
before dawn ruins the sky.
Yeah, but he doesn't. There's no fight. It basically is. There's one big parry and then gone.
Well, okay, but they charged together, Shang and Sevatar.
Sevatar didn't need the help. Yeah, so Alaho dies, his sacrifice giving him a few seconds, and those seconds basically work well because he rams Kurz's neck with his sword, basically letting the lion get off the ground with almost getting killed himself. Corswain basically jumps on Kurz's back and tries to ride him like a horse. It doesn't go well.
Straight through the spine of one of the Emperor's sons.
Ugh, good stuff. He's been shrugged off like a bothersome insect. Even strangled, beaten, bleeding, cut, and stabbed, Kurz had hurled him aside with almost no effort at all.
Yeah, that says something about the Emperor's gene forging there.
Yep.
And whatever warp magic that he used to create those Primarchs.
Can't say that.
Wait,
I mean, true, but you can't say
it. Special sauce.
Yes. Special chemical science.
That's right.
Science. So he basically is down on the ground. He's just, badly beaten just by being thrown by the Night Hunter. He didn't even get hit. He didn't even get tagged or anything. He just got hurled off of him like an insect, crashed into the ground, rolled a few times, but his entire left side felt shattered, literally broken into fragments. That's kind of rough. That is quite a body slam, really.
Yeah, only one leg and one arm obeyed his knees. One shattered eye lens showed a flawed, lagging view of the foundation site. The other showed nothing at all.
All right, so basically he's on the ground. He watches as the lion and Kurz resume their duel, even though they're both now, bleeding and much worse for wear. And Sevatar comes over to finish him off, and suddenly the cavalry arrives. The first drop pod hammered home into a gravel slope, sending ashy stones spraying out in a burst of debris. The heat shielding on its black hull glowed from the atmospheric descent, while the whining turbines hissed with vented steam. It's so good to see them come. So basically, the second landed a second later, the third and the fourth, the Dark Angels are here in force, or at least, the strike cruiser worth of them. And Sevatar and Shang disappear as quickly as they were almost descending on Corswain to finish him off. This is the best part of the whole book, basically. They basically come to their respective Primarchs, the Night Lords and the Dark Angels, and they're fighting the whole while, but they're pulling away their Primarchs, like, prize fighters who have beaten each other to bloody pulps. And the two Primarchs staggered back from one another, cursing each other above their sons' heads, both hindered by weakened limbs and grievous wounds that made the air stink with their genetically divine blood. But the whole time, they're screaming and trying to shrug off their sons to fight further, to continue. It's crazy. And it, again, like you said, the Night Hunter has brought the lion down to his level, to having this back alley knife fight, not a knight anymore, again, K-N-I-G-H-T, but a savage like him. So, so good.
The line, you skipped past it, but
the rattling, last
rattling like hailstones, more drop pods fell from above. You know how fast they have to be launching drop pods to have them rattle like hailstones?
Yeah.
Good God.
So this is good. Two more lines. His last vision was of the Primarchs, both near driven to their knees, surrounded by growing phalanxes of their armored sons. Kurz reached his claws for the lion's snarling and cursing, too weak to resist his legion dragging him from the field. The lion's reaction was a foul mirror, made all the more hideous because of the warlord's majesty. He screamed oaths from his bleeding, angelic face, pulled back from the battle by his own sons. And then, Corswain is being helped up by some other dark angels, and they say, "My sword!" Corswain reaches their hand out as if he could touch the opposing groups of warriors. "Where is it, your grace?" "Gone!" Corswain closed his remaining eye. "I left it in a Primarch's spine."
Yeah, that's awesome.
So good. So, basically, nothing is solved here because the Thromas Crusade continues for quite a while until basically the Dark Angels catch up with the Night Lord fleet by surprise and ambush it and wreak holy havoc and kill tens of thousands of Night Lords, probably. It doesn't really go into numbers, but they take a grievous number of losses.
But don't they finally catch up to them after Kurz basically abandons them?
So they catch up with them, and then the Night Lords flee, and the Night Lords are basically counting their losses and trying to figure out what they're going to do. I think this is in Prince of Crows. And Kurz is in a coma. He's basically in a healing coma. They're not sure what to do with him. They basically say all the apothecaries are like, "We have no freaking clue what half of these organs do," and right. The other half are shut down. It's a really cool scene because they're basically, you know, staring at the corpse of their Primarch, who is alive, but barely, and they don't even understand how he's barely alive. They have no idea what to do for him. Any palliative care that they give him is not designed for him. They were never trained in treating him. There's no training for that out there. There's no book on Primarch physiology. It's really cool. And that's when Sevatar shows his psychic powers and goes in to see if Night Hunter is alive or dead.
Right. I remember that now.
But that's enough.
It's similar to the same kind of thing that happened to Fulgrim with the Emperor's children when he was wounded. The Medicaid, they had no idea what to do.
Yes. Yep.
Just at a loss.
Yep. And the same with Horus.
Right. And Horus, the wound, of course, was supernatural for Orphan. But yes. So there's huge damage here, but it's actually worse for Night Hunter than it turns out to be for
the lion,
because you see the lion in the end of the short story is still alive. It's still alive and up and walking around and basically promotes Corswain for his service. But they basically, you know, devote themselves to continuing to defend the Thromas and not trying to go to Terra, even though, you know, they probably couldn't make it anyway because of the warp storm. But basically that, you know, he can't abandon a piece of the Imperium to save the heart of the Imperium, because what's the point? And that's true, but it also means that he's not there when he's probably needed the most. Although we do learn more about that in later stories as well.
Right.
You know, this is funny. Actually, I just thought about this. So he says that, you know, they're not going to give up on Thromas, and I guess they don't, because they basically kick the Night Lords out of Thromas later in the twin ambushes of the Night Lord fleet. And then you're talking about basically Night Hunter leaves his ship and goes on board. I think it's the Invincible Reason. Is that the flagship of the Dark Angels?
Yep.
Yes.
He basically takes the fight back to the Dark Angels, boards it with the Atramentar, who are the first company Terminator elite, who Sevatar is the leader of, but Sevatar is not with them because he basically leaves Sevatar behind in his thirst for glory and blood. Not really glory, mostly just blood. It's a great story. Prince of Crows, worth reading.
I need to go back and reread it.
We've spoiled all of it now, but it's still worth reading. So he doesn't give up on Thromas, even though he has this whole speech here about, you know, if we don't defend the rest of the Empire, defending Terra means nothing. So it's true. I was just thinking, because he later then goes to join Roboot and Sanguinius at Ultramar. But I guess at that point, Thromas is safe because the Night Lords have been defeated and split up. Anyway, so what did you guys think of the story? Glenn and I were talking, before I let you talk, Glenn and I were talking before we started recording, that just this book has got just great story after great story. This is Age of 100%. Darkness, the 10th book of the Horus Heresy. And it is, I think it's the first short story collection, and all of these stories are good. Some of them are fantastic. Yeah. But because there's a couple of them that we're going, I don't actually remember that one, but it's probably good. You know, we've covered a couple of them. We've covered The Iron Within. We covered The Liars Do. Rules of Engagement, if you haven't read it yet, is a fantastic story.
Fantastic story.
Fantastic.
Once you get done reading it, you have to go back to the beginning and reread it again, knowing what you know at the end.
See the clues that you missed along the way.
Yep.
So anyway, this is a great book. This is a great story. I think this is probably, even though, again, I'm an Iron Warrior player, and I'm not yet a Night Lord player, but it'll happen. I think this is the best story just because it humanizes the Night Lords to a degree. I mean, you don't really know a ton about Nighthaunter at this point in the fiction. He's covered as sort of, you know, tragic character, but you get more of it here. And then you get much more of it in Prince of Crows, rather. He is a monster, but he's a monster that at least has motivation for what he does.
It's sick, like twisted motivation, but yeah, it's motivation.
Well, you know, the thing is that it does work. And again, the Emperor created him. The Emperor knew what he was.
Yep.
How could he not?
Right.
Okay.
He had a role for him.
So, I know Glenn and I discussed this. This might be just a little exercise here, but the Lion and Kurz both landed on their respective planets and were alone. The Lion was raised by himself in the wilds with no one to protect him. Kurz was raised by himself with no one to protect him or raise him. Both of them came up fighting and killing in their respective worlds. But the Lion went back into, I'm going to use air quotes here, you know, civilized society, where I don't think Kurz ever really did.
No. He always stayed as in the shadows.
He was killing civilized society because they were evil.
Yep.
Right.
In his eyes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have two Primarchs raised in a similar way, but both of them turn out very, very different.
Very different. Well, yeah, there's a line. There's a line that
different.
Says, sorry, Glenn.
No problem.
That at one point the Lion regarded Kurz as his closest brother because they were both raised, you know, on savage worlds, basically. But that, I've never heard that come up before. No one has ever really been close to Kurz. He's always been pretty outcast by his brothers. And I don't think, I feel like Angron was the same way. Nobody really related to Angron or Conrad Kurz because they were loners. You know, Angron, because his people all died, he didn't really want his legion. And Kurz didn't really want his legion, especially when they were filled with rapists and murderers.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the traitor legions had some sort of daddy issues or lack of daddy issues.
Everybody does. All of the biggest tragedy of the Horus Heresy is these guys are basically teenagers, the Primarchs,
right?
Given superhuman powers and then some, and given this responsibility from their dad, the Emperor, who then abandons them. And some of them take it better than others. Some of them, you know, are mad that Horus got elevated. Some of them are mad that, you know, he left them when, you know, they don't fully understand what the hell they're doing up there. You know, the ones that have the most duty in them, like Rogaldorn and the Lion, they have kind of the easiest time adjusting to it because they understand what's their responsibilities are and what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to go out there and conquer worlds for dad. That's fine. We're going to take care of it.
And they're supposed to do it because the Emperor said so.
Yeah. Well, that's their dad's legacy for them is you will go out and conquer. But like Lorgar handled it quite poorly, and Nighthaunter handled it quite poorly too, because he did what he was expected to do, but his brothers didn't like the way that he did it. And so he felt, you know, kind of backstabbed by his brothers because, again, he had his father's blessing. If he didn't have his father's blessing, why would he be doing this? Why would he still be in charge of a legion? I mean, that to him was permission to go out and be himself.
Yeah. Rob, have you read the new Alpharius book?
I have not read it yet.
Okay. So in that, it actually says that...
spoiler warning.
That the custodes, if the Emperor tells them to do something, they can't even inadvertently disobey an order. Even by accident, they can't. It's ingrained in them. They cannot disobey an order. Whereas the Primarchs, they can.
Yeah,
whether it's inadvertently. Yeah, they're not the same. And Alpharius was wondering if that's a flaw, if that obedience, why wouldn't the Emperor want them to be just as obedient?
Well, if you think about it, the Custode's role is very different from the Primarch. The Primarchs are generals in the Galactic Crusade. The Custodes are really just guardians. I mean, their job is a lot easier, protect the Emperor. Prosecuting a war is a lot harder than defending a man's life, to be a bodyguard. I know the Custodes sometimes take the field, but it's pretty rare. You know, that's kind of one of the criticisms of them in 40K is Reboot comes to Earth. It's like, you have let things go to shit because you're standing around here watching this, you know, corpse man when you could be out there making a difference. And you've been doing it for 10,000 years. Shame on you. Which, of course, now is why now they're the most OP bastards on the game. What are you going to do? Spoiler warning.
Wait, what was that phrase? Crush him up into a ball and dick kick him into the sun?
I get that. And it's funny because I know that the Custodes in some ways are like mini Primarchs. I mean, they are badass guys.
Right.
But they don't have the same responsibility on their shoulders. The 10,000 are just bodyguards. I mean, they don't fight well as warriors or as soldiers. They fight well as warriors.
Individually, they fight better as
individuals. They're badasses. Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's like even – and it's funny because I think this is Master of Mankind when they're fighting in the Webway, they resent everybody. It's like because everybody else is failable compared to them, except that they're dying in droves too. The 10,000 is like down to 1,000 or something through the war in the Webway. And they're really pissed about it because it's not their job. But Magnus kind of, you know, did something wrong. Take that, people who say Magnus did nothing wrong.
Magnus has done a lot of things wrong.
He did a lot. Well, I mean,
Fury of Magnus is pretty good.
It's a pretty good book. I agree. Have you started reading Mortis yet?
No.
I just started. So.
Okay.
The audiobook is not out yet. It's sad. I have to actually read a book. What the hell?
I can't read.
I think it's on Audible, isn't it?
Not yet. Unless it came on this week. I have been checking every week. I have not checked this week. I will check after this recording.
I could have sworn it was up there last week.
It was not.
I almost downloaded it.
I'm going to look right now.
I'm looking even as we speak.
On my phone.
Phonics works for me.
John, say something while Glenn and I race to see if it's on there. French. It is not on there. Not yet released on Audible. I don't know why, but not there. I actually went looking. There was a thread on Reddit of people crying because they, too, don't like to read books anymore. It's not true. It's funny because I'll have something going in Audible and be reading something at the same time. I have no problem doing that. I can keep multiple stories straight in my head. It's weird, right?
You mean separately, but at the same time?
Yes.
Because if you can do both, if you can read and listen at the same time, you are a bad mamma jamma.
No, that is... maybe in my youth, but not today. Not with the brain fog of being 47. Ugh.
I swear it was there. I'm like, sweet. I was like, I'll get it next week, and now it's not there.
Coming soon.
Maybe.
Yep, not there yet. I have 3 credits for Audible. I'm just waiting for it.
I have 9. Ha ha ha, I have more.
Jeez. Catch up, man. Come on. All right, so what do you guys, who's next?
John is.
All right, John, got any ideas?
And we can sit and we can have a conversation about the different... different Primarchs, like we just did. I mean, there's, you know, 20.
There's 21.
We know about 18 of them.
19.
I can't do math. It's late.
First was first. Second.
But we can figure out, you know, if each Primarch is a different aspect of, or at least a partial aspect of the Emperor, we could kind of compare and contrast the ones that we know about to try and figure out a little bit more possibly about the second and the 11th.
Well, we know what their monikers were. It's the Forgotten and
the Lost.
Yeah.
So one turned to chaos and one, it was permanently forgotten because he messed up.
Possibly.
or got wiped out by the Rangdang.
And wasn't it, there was some discussion that the Ultramarines absorbed
Yes. One
of the legions, some of their warriors.
All of the legions got some, but the Ultramarines got more.
Ultramarines and Word Bearers got more.
Which became why they became the biggest legions aside from the Iron Warriors.
Yeah.
Those are the top three most numerous for a time. I mean, the numbers fluctuated.
Mm-hmm.
We could, I don't know. I mean, it would take some research, which, you know, we're really good at, to try and get, because there's clues littered throughout all the stories. Not all the stories, I'm sorry, that's a lie. Through many stories, there are clues about the brothers. There's even some really cool stuff in, I think it's Praetorian of Dorne,
yep.
Where they talk about the statues for the lost and the forgotten.
Yep.
And there's some reference that there was a vote that Lorgar could have been eradicated like them in First Heretic. Basically, Magnus comes to him and says, you know, well, we almost took you out, but I voted against it, and so did Leman Russ, which surprised Lorgar. But he basically said Leman Russ didn't want to do it again, didn't want to be the headsman
right.
another time, the third time.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, he then comes from Magnus in the same fashion, so it does. He's not that upset about it.
Well, Magnus had it coming.
Kinda.
Yeah. Kinda. Yeah, he made it so the Emperor had to sit on the Golden Throne for 10,000 years.
Boy, was his ass sore about
that's right.
that.
I think his whole body sore at this point. It's just one big sore.
What's left of it.
Oh, so wrong.
We'll figure it out.
Yep. All right, so we're not telling you what we're going to talk about next time because we don't know ourselves. That's the fine organization here at a Legion of Three.
Hope you liked it.
Catch you next time.
It was fun. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you.